This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about stigma. So for our first one of the year, it's really nice to be, I guess, reminding ourselves of our core mission, what we're all about, reducing stigma. And in particular, we're talking about one area of it that can be often overlooked, and certainly something that I wasn't aware of in terms of the scale before starting this show. And that is the stigma that exists within medical communities. It can be so easy for us, and perhaps, you know, that's what we want to think, that the very people that are treating mental health are above the stigma, have somehow surpassed it. But as we know, when it's this ingrained in our society, that is a lot easier said than done.
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, I love that opening statement around our core mission being reducing stigma. You know, because we don't speak specifically perhaps about stigma each week, the whole essence of what we're doing is there to reduce stigma. And that's what hopefully we're doing well at. And that's the feedback that we're getting. But yeah, you forget that actually what we're doing is doing that each week, or how we live our lives in our work anyway, regardless of the podcast. But I totally agree with you. And I think sometimes I find it quite difficult at times to lift myself out of, there's an almost an added guilt then of, well, you know better. On paper, you know better. There's been times when I've thought in my past, like, well, you're just going to sit there and think that you know things, you know stuff. So you sort yourself out. So I guess that's my stigma. And I know we're talking about, you know, stigma for mental health professionals, but that's what we do, you and I as well. And I can see why it's a thing.
Right. And I think it's really important to talk about it for that reason, because the catch of it is, you know, we're expecting better of our mental health professionals, which is, you know, understandable that with the work we do, we would look up to them. But that doesn't mean they're above humanity. They're above the concerns that we all have, the flaws that we all need to overcome. And mental health stigma is one of those. But you're exactly right that that's a big part of it, is feeling that you should know better. And I've definitely been guilty of that so many times. You can know logically what mental ill health is like, but I still catch myself thinking, ugh, this is so silly, this particular worry, or, you know, me feeling depressed today, but not having a reason. Like, your brain can still slip into that negative way of thinking of, like, why is there not more logic to this illness? It's like, well, this is an illness of your mind, so it is going to affect logic, you know? It's not going to make sense sometimes. But, yeah, you know, we can have to remind ourselves of that. And our guest is really eloquent on, you know, on that subject, on the kind of self-stigma she had, and how, you know, there's difficulties in the industry, but also there's things that each physician has to overcome. And before recording, I had a quick look back at some of the past guests we've had on, thinking through the interviews, and I've noticed we've had a nurse, a psychiatrist, a GP, a medical student, just to reference four guests who have all talked about stigma, where it's come up in all of them. And so that's how widespread it is.
Well, absolutely. And I think traditionally, a lot of the greatest psychologists and psychiatrists that we've known in history have often dealt with their own mental illnesses. And I think if you spend your whole life and your whole career looking deeply into the mind and into personality and into behaviour, in terms of the industry and the stigma from colleagues, perhaps, again, comes from that, any job that, you know, you're putting in so many hours and it's highly pressured and you're so committed and you're on it all the time, there's, again, that expectation. You're thinking, oh, I'm struggling with my mental health and I'm a surgeon and I shouldn't be, because my colleagues are fine. They're dealing with the same pressures that I'm dealing with. So why should I stand out and say, I can't cope with this? COVID is a prime example. There are nurses and doctors who are dealing with complete burnout, but then looking at their colleagues and thinking, well, other people are, so should I really?
All feeling the same thing, no doubt. And I was thinking about, you know, how this would contrast with other industries. And you mentioned earlier, like a mechanic, you know, is one example where it's not, you know, related to mental health in your day-to-day work. you know, even with something like that, you can see how, of course, there's going to be stigma. Actually, when you take a moment to think about it, of course there is. In the same way, a mechanic, if their car broke down on the way to work, it'd be a bit embarrassing for them, you know? Well, that's it. And it's no more their fault. Like, you know, cars break down. Of course they do. That doesn't mean you're a bad mechanic or you have a bad car necessarily. Your ability to fix it is what makes you a good mechanic. And I think we can kind of apply that in this situation, that you are not a good doctor because you've happened to not experience severe mental ill health, because that is partly down to chance among any number of other things of what happens in your life. But it's how you deal with that, you know. And if you are scared to seek treatment because of the stigma, you are then going against the very thing you would encourage a patient to do. And so Lynette talks about that very eloquently as well, that how well is the mental health issues managed?
Yeah, and that's a great point. And I read an article written by a GP that in the British Medical Journal about attending an annual associates meeting. And she was saying, you know, it was brilliant that in the past there never would have been so much talking about mental illness, and they actually addressed doctor burnout and psychiatric illness within the medical profession for up to 70% of that annual meeting was about that, and how they need to support junior doctors and junior medical professionals and all throughout, but especially coming into it. And we've spoken about that before, I think, haven't we, on the podcast, about there has been a lot more work this last year or two changing curriculum for learning for doctors and nurses, and how they can really start supporting that, and for them to get support for their own mental health. So I think hopefully, you know, things are starting to change, but yeah, how it's managed is the key point, really.
For sure. And we actually had a previous interview with a medical student. She's since gone on to qualify, so I'll see if I can dig out the link for that for the episode description as well, because that was fascinating hearing firsthand where the support could be better, but also, you know, what she was able to overcome and learn through the stigma. So interesting stuff. We've got a few stats actually from the guest via a TED talk she did, which I'd really encourage people to go take a look at as well. We'll dig out the link for that one. And the first one is that 400 physicians die by suicide in the US every year. And within that, they are twice as likely to die by suicide as non-physicians, so the general population.
Wow.
Which just for me really hammers home how vital this is. And to reference a stat that would relate to our Jenny, our medical student, medical students are 3 times more likely to die by suicide than members of the general population. So it's even higher for the ones that are just starting out, that don't have a lot of the resources. A lot of them are between, their needs are a bit more specialised in the counselling service at the university, but they're not yet fully integrated in a hospital and the support that would be there. So there can be medical students falling through the cracks, but even in the last few years, that is definitely getting a lot better. So 2 massive statistics there. So really glad to be covering this, starting off the year with a really important topic, but also a fascinating interview. Lynette is a joy to talk to. She's a doctor of anesthesiology. I think I've just about said right, because I struggle with that word. I would say a doctor of anesthetics, because that's easier to say. So yeah, putting people to sleep for surgery, usually. And she's really funny. She's gone into comedy as part of a sideline of hers to help deal with some of the stress of the job. Comedy's become a big outlet for her, and you really feel that through the interview. She can have such humour about, you know, some really tough situations, and just comes across as an incredibly warm, reassuring person. Really everything you'd want in a doctor. So delighted to meet her and get to do this interview. Anything else you wanted to mention?
No, I think we've covered that.
Cool, all set then. So please enjoy this interview with Lynette Charity. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Hi, I'm Lynette Charity. Let me just tell you a story. When I was 6 years old, I was going to an ice cream store with my 2 brothers and my 2-year-old sister. This was the segregated South. I lived in a segregated neighborhood, and we were about to cross the street. And out of nowhere, we still don't understand it to this day. It's been now 66 years ago, but all of a sudden, this car came out of nowhere and hit my two-year-old sister and killed her. I was 6, my brothers were 9 and 10. And as I observed her in the street, I really wanted to help her. I didn't know how to help her. But back in the day, when things like this happen, children were seen and not heard. And all they did with us was gathered us up and took us to a place and just said, you stay here. Things were taking place we didn't understand. And honestly, I didn't even know that my sister was dead. Death for me as a 6-year-old was not something that I understood. And when Beverly didn't come home later on and people started talking, I realized the person that I loved the most in my life at the time, she was my best friend, she was never coming home. And what happened after that was that when people experience trauma, they react to it in different ways. And for children especially, not understanding what this all is about, they usually react with anxiety and anger. And that was me. I'm 6 years old, I'm getting ready to start first grade, and I was teased a lot during that time. You know, kids don't really understand about all of this, but I was the girl whose sister got hit by the car and killed. And every time someone would say that, it would bring back that vision, and it made me a very, very angry little girl. And that was the beginning of what I would say. Now, I also, as you all know, family history of depression is something that also can be a part of this. My father was in the Army. He fought in World War II in the segregated American Army, and he went to the Philippines. Blacks at that time didn't do a lot of fighting. They did the menial tasks that they did in the States. And he was a truck driver, but he was an interesting truck driver, because he drove something called the dead truck. And all that meant was that his job was to drive around the battlefield and pick up the dead bodies of the soldiers. Well, one time his truck fell over and buried him underneath it for a day with a bunch of dead bodies. And we now call this post-traumatic stress syndrome, but back then it was called shell shock. But my father went mad. He actually had to be sent back to the States, and he was put into a psychiatric hospital for a period of time. Now, we can say that trauma can cause this. We can say a lot of things about it, but my father became a very, very angry man. At that point, he became an abusive person. He would use my mother as a punching bag. And this is the life that I grew up in, on top of having a sister that was killed at a very young age. And all of this imprinted upon me a feeling of I was not a very happy child. My mom said that when my sister died, that my smile disappeared. And I really do feel that. I just focused on what I could. In fact, I made my sister an imaginary friend. And that is how I coped. That's the way I coped for the longest time. Beverly was my friend. I would talk to her all the time. Whenever I got into any situations, I would just talk to Beverly. And so my life up to a certain point was just very sad little girl that the only thing that made me happy was books. I loved books. I would run away in books. It was hard for me to find anything else during that period of time to make me happy. So I would end up reading things like, you know, Heidi. I would go to the Alps with Heidi, and I would just imagine not being in the world that I was in. And that is how I coped up to a certain point. And that's what people with depression and other mental illnesses do for a while, is that we just find ways to just get through life, to slog through life the best we can. And for the longest time, that helped me until it didn't.
That's devastating to hear, but so well articulated, going through that experience, dealing with an unimaginable loss, you know, something you can't wrap your head around. So, of course, like you say, you know, we reach out to the coping mechanisms we have to hand. Do you feel like there was also a link between your dad's behavior when he was struggling to cope and that turned into aggression and how you showed aggression?
You know, he was a role model for aggression, as you can imagine. And so he would hit my mother and I went around hitting anytime anyone said anything. I had no filter. I had no way to process my anger. I didn't understand the anger. And so that's the way I reacted. In fact, I got into so much trouble that I had a great aunt who was a principal of a what we call Negro high elementary school back then. And I spent a lot of time at her place because I would get into a fight at school. She would come pick me up. But the one thing she did for me was she gave me tasks to do. I had to clean the library. I had to sort the books. She gave me things for me to focus on so that I wouldn't focus on whatever it was that was troubling me. She would say, "You're a smart girl, Lynette. You know, you got to stop this nonsense." And I didn't understand how to do that, but it was very calming for me to, like I said, get into the books. She would make things to do all day long. So I didn't have to think, because the thinking was the biggest problem. Once I started getting into my own thoughts, that picture of Beverly would pop up and it hurt. It still hurts. I mean, I'm 68 years old now and I can still see that vision of what happened to my sister. And it will always be there. But yeah, she did find some ways to calm me down. And it was busy work. And also, I fell in love with school. I really enjoyed it. I got into a lot of fights, so sometimes I couldn't stay in school. But once I figured out a way to stay in my world that I had created for myself, I was better able to cope with the real world. And that meant that I was able to then go into a school setting. And despite all of the things that were going on, I was able to focus on my schoolwork. My schoolwork became my focus. I had no friends. I couldn't deal with that. As I said, Beverly was my friend. I had no friends, but I had my schoolwork and I was a very, very bright student. And I had my aunt and some of the other women in my, I call them the matriarchs of my family, that just sort of kept me grounded. Because otherwise, I don't know what I would be today. In fact, I probably would not be here today if it hadn't been for them.
Wow, that's fascinating. And also with your aunt, it sounds like even if she wasn't consciously doing this, she was giving you coping mechanisms. She was giving you something to rely on. And in that kind of structure and, you know, the reading and, you know, going into academia, I think there can be a reassuring sense of boundaries. You know, when you've gone through something like that at such a young age, of course, you'll struggle to wrap your head around it. So there must have been something reassuring about the boundaries of the stories you were reading. And then in your academia, the rights and the wrongs of the world. And we can really buy into this idea that there is a reason for the way things work. And that is very much a scientific way of thinking. Do you feel like that then contributed to the work you ended up in?
Yeah. I tell people that I floundered around for about 3 years because I didn't have a purpose. I didn't have something that I really, really could wrap my head around. And in 1961, when I was 9 years old, we had all these TV shows in America. Doctor shows were very popular. And two shows came out that year. One was called Dr. Kildare, and the other one was Ben Casey. I watched Ben Casey one night, and literally, it was almost like a light bulb went off. I'm only 9 years old, but he comes on, and of course, it's black and white. We had a 19-inch Philco TV, black and white, and he comes on, and he looks at me. I felt like he was looking at me. And saying to me, "Lynette, you're going to be a doctor." And in fact, when the show was over and everything, I turned to my mom. I said, "Mama, I'm going to be a doctor." And she goes, "That's nice, child, you know, kind of thing." You know, because I am nine. But what was interesting, though, she heard me because about 3 weeks later, I come home from school and on my bed is a doctor kit. And in it, it had a stethoscope, it had a blood pressure cuff, it had a reflex hammer, you know, it had a fake syringe. And, you know, it was like, Dr. Charity is in the house. My goal then was, I'm going to make Beverly proud. She and I are going to become doctors. And I focused on that. And then I said, all right, well, if I'm going to do this, I got to stop my shenanigans. I got to focus better, learn how to control my anger, and I need to get good grades. That's what I need to do. Now, back then, schools were segregated. I lived in a segregated community, and there was a white school not too far from us, but I couldn't go there at the time. And we had a Supreme Court decision back in 1954, Brown versus Board of Education, which was supposed to integrate the schools. Well, I tell people that Virginia didn't get the memo. It took them about 12 years. So 1966, they did integrate the schools. And the first thing I said was, well, I've got to go to that school because they've got better books. Because I'd heard all these stories about the white schools, you know, being paved in gold and that, you know, the teachers were this and that. And I said, oh, well, I want to go there because if I'm going to become a doctor, I have to get the best education possible. And my mother didn't want me to go because if you know any of our history, once blacks started integrating white high schools, there was a lot of evilness that went on. People were being beaten. The National Guard had to come out. And my mom said, no, I don't want you to do this because I think that they will hurt you. And I go, Mom, they're not going to bother me. You know, I'm just a 15-year-old. I just want to go to school and get an education. Well, she wouldn't let me go. So I forged her name on the transfer documents. And when she found out, she was a little upset, but I got to go. And first day, there was no bus, so I had to walk to this school. I had to leave the comforts of my neighborhood, cross a major thoroughfare, go through the white neighborhood to get to this school. And along the way, I was tormented by the people that lived in the white neighborhood. But there was something about the fact that this was my purpose, this is what I needed to do, and I was going to do it. And I did. I got through, you know, they threw things at me, called me names, but it was interesting because of the fact that I had this thought in my mind that I was going to become a doctor and I wasn't going to let anything mess with that because it actually was what was keeping me sane, I think, just having this purpose. And I wasn't going to allow these extraneous people to affect that. And I did. I went to that school. I graduated with honors. And even though I was told by the guidance counselor there that, you know, you might be able to get into one of those Negro colleges, but no medical school is going to take a colored girl, I proved her wrong. I ended up getting a full academic scholarship to college, and then I went on to medical school.
Wow, I love that. And I also want to pause on, you know, the kind of imagery of that as well, because I think there's such a refreshing mentality that can come with youth. That, you know, if you describe that time to me as an adult, you know, I think of the pictures, you know, and I'd encourage people to look them up if they're not familiar. When you're talking about the National Guard, you know, there's images of little girls, even in primary school, walking into schools with guards either side, because that's how severe the threat of violence was. And, you know, oftentimes they're skipping into the school because they're excited about a new school and every adult looks terrified and the kid's skipping.
Yeah. I just, as I said, the adults were afraid for me. My mother was afraid for me, you know, a lot of people, but I went there to prove people wrong in one way, but also to validate me as being able to do the work because I was told that as a Black, that I was going to fail and be returned to my school. And I said, nope, no, that's not going to happen because of the fact that I am dedicated to getting an education. If you're willing to teach me, I'm willing to learn. And fortunately for me, despite the color of my skin, I had some allies at that school because the one thing about science is almost colorblind. You know, I had a science teacher that saw the joy that I had in science she was my mentor there. It was just amazing to watch a person who had lived a life of segregation all of a sudden embracing me because I loved what she was doing. I loved chemistry. I loved biology. I loved anything science. I think I changed her mind about a lot of things, especially about the fact that I had a brain and that I could actually learn. Because there was this concept that for some reason that we couldn't learn, that it was not in our makeup to be able to be educated in the way that the white kids were being educated. But I proved them wrong. I mean, like I said, I was an honor student and I joined everything. That was the other thing is that I was in the student government. I was in the French club, you know, and I won the French poetry contest. I did my little poetry in French and I won. And I was educating them and I was learning also. So it was one of those things of the 3 years that I spent at that school, I didn't necessarily have a lot of friends, but I had enough people that believed she's going places, she's going to do something because she's dedicated herself to the education. And I didn't let anyone get in my way. That was the key too.
Definitely. And so then you do go on and graduate and you start off in your professional role. How were you then in terms of how you were treated, but also how was your mental health at that point?
Well, I had done very well coping all the way through college because college was a wonderful experience for me. I went to an all-women's college and I had wonderful friends, wonderful support. And I was accepted to Tufts Medical School in Boston, Massachusetts. And the first day of being there, we're having orientation, and one of my brand new classmates, white male, comes up to me, sort of nudges me over to the side, and he points to me and he goes, you know, you're lucky to be here. They got a twofer with you, affirmative action. They got a black and a female. You're probably going to flunk out. It just caught me off guard. It was like, what? We had something back then called affirmative action. It was sort of a quota system where they were trying to, you know, get equality for those of us who may not have had the opportunities, may have had the brain power, but not the opportunities. And yes, maybe I was brought into Tufts on a quota system, but, you know, I graduated with honors from my college. And I kept trying to rationalize this. I graduated with honors, you know, I did this, but maybe I don't belong here. And that's when the voices and the creepiness, you know, started in my head. And that's when my depression really got out of hand, where I started to isolate myself because I was afraid. I literally was afraid someone was going to come and knock on my door and say, Lynette, we made a mistake. You're not supposed to be here. And I had no plan B. All I wanted to be was a doctor. That's all I hadn't planned on anything else. If they had said, you don't belong here, I don't know what I would have done. So I studied all the time. I isolated myself from everyone. I wasn't sleeping and I wasn't eating. And mid-year, I was in my histology class and I collapsed and I was rushed to the hospital. Turns out that I had lost about 30 pounds. I weighed about 80 pounds at the time. And, you know, they did all the workup and everything there. But hindsight's always 20/20. I'm sure that I had gone through a psychotic break, a depressive break at that time. But, you know, this was the 70s. So a lot of people didn't know a lot about mental illness. So they did a whole complete workup on me because some of the manifestations of depression, as you know, is that you eat too much or you sleep too much or you eat too little, you sleep too little. You have vague, you know, gastrointestinal symptoms. You know, I always had abdominal pain because that's why I wouldn't eat, because when I would eat, it would hurt. So I'm in the hospital and they do all of these tests. They thought that I had irritable bowel syndrome, which is sort of a kind of a catch-all kind of thing when they're not sure. And that was the diagnosis they gave me. And then they said, well, go back to medical school and, you know, eat. You know, that was their advice. Eat and, you know, get back in there and do your work. Well, then on top of that, my father died. My father had been suffering with esophageal cancer for about a year, and he was only 50 years old. and he died. And so they put me on a plane and sent me home to Virginia to go to his funeral. When I get off the plane, I collapse and I end up in the hospital. I miss his funeral, which was okay with me. I never did like, after going to my sister's funeral, I never liked funerals after that. In the Baptist religion, people like to have open caskets. And imagine being a six-year-old looking at your sister in a casket. That memory came, and it's like, I don't really want to see my father in a casket. But I get there, and I collapse, and I'm hospitalized. And that's when I contemplated killing myself, because I didn't feel like I could go back to medical school at that point in time. I just stopped eating. You know, I was home. And the amazing thing that happened is that even if people don't understand about mental illness or whatever, they figure something's wrong. But I had a mentor in medical school. Her name was Dr. Vivian Penn. She called my mother to check on me. My mother said, you know, she's not doing really well. She just won't eat. She won't do this. And Dr. Penn told her, you send her back here. We will get her through this. We will take care of her. And my mom threw me on a plane. I went back to Boston. And literally, my classmates, the professors, Dr. Penn, everybody got involved and made sure I ate, made sure I attended classes. I had some makeup exams I had to do. But by the time that year was over, I ended up being able to go on to second year with my classmates. And so I got through that episode with the help. They never called it anything. They just said, we're just going to help her. But that's not the end of my story. All of a sudden, I wasn't cured or anything like that. I went on.
I just want to stop on that, though, because it's interesting how well that was handled in many ways within the context of the stigma and the misunderstanding. But I think at the same time, grief is something that, to an extent, we know what to do with. We may not feel equipped to have a lot of conversations about grief, but we know almost intrinsically that it's a time to rally round someone. And so I wonder, had you been struggling at a time without something like your dad passing, if the support would have been quite so immediate?
Well, I honestly think that if I had just gone back to medical school out once I got out of the hospital, and that I did not have, as you said, this rallying around of people, because I'm not sure that I would have made it. I think that that added, they saw the grief part as a rallying around cry versus the part where I had the issue with the student that, you know, talked about affirmative action, you know, kind of thing. Because I really didn't share that with them as to why. But you're right. Yeah, they rallied around me because, you know, my father died. It was very traumatic kind of thing. And they were very helpful. Yeah.
That's good. And in a sad way, though, I'm not surprised you didn't share that experience with the student because of a number of factors. You know, one, we know that imposter syndrome is very common in academia. You know, when there's such competitive placements, particularly in the sciences, so many people go through their whole career feeling like they've got there on chance. And then here you were presented with some rationale to back that up, seemingly. And for context for the listeners, when you mention affirmative action, we're not talking about maybe the modern version of it where we think about, you know, something like a gender split and trying to get 50-50 in management. We're talking about these universities wouldn't have had any students of color at all unless there was a rule. You know, so this was the very bare minimum. This wasn't, you know, what we might think of as a quota today.
Yeah, very good. But you know your history, Bobby. That's very good. Yeah. And I tell people I had imposter syndrome before imposter syndrome was imposter syndrome, because it actually, the terminology came right about that time, because this is 1970s. We talk about it a lot now, but that's what I was feeling when that all occurred, is that, you know, somehow I didn't belong there, that they were going to kick me out. But yeah, my problem happened, though, as you alluded to, in medicine, there is this concept that physicians are not human. You know, I've gotten so upset during this period of time with COVID and everything, where they're talking about we're superheroes, we're this, we're that. You know, we are human beings like everyone else. We get cancer, we get heart disease, we get lung disease, and we have mental illness. Some of us bring our mental illness with us, which is me. And if you think about it, they even talk about now 75% of, at least in our country, approximately 75% of medical students are on some kind of antidepressant when they go to medical school because they have already exhibited symptoms of mental illness. And yet, when they come into medical school, they feel very strongly that they have to take themselves off because of the fact of that stigma of the fact that you can't have a mental illness if you're going to be a doctor. And I struggled with that for so long because I had my cyclical depressive periods for a long, long time. And I would just kind of, we talk about having that Socratic method of teaching and stuff where you have to just buck up, you know, do it. You can do, you know, 18 hours and then get up and do another 18 hours. And you can do all these things. But our bodies are just like everybody else's bodies. Our brains are like everybody else's. And we would do it and we would muddle through it. But the bottom line is that some of us didn't survive it along the way. And I honestly didn't know a lot about physician suicide and mental health issues until I personally almost died by suicide. And it was an interesting event for me because I had been coping the best way I can. I actually did a lot of different things. I took up running because I also suffer from seasonal affective disorder. So I would take up running and I would tell people, it's amazing how many people you can cuss out in 26.2 miles. Because I would go and run marathons, that endorphin rush and all of that, it would just light my brain up and whatever doldrums I was in, I would get better. I developed a kindred friendship with three or four people. And we would go out and have dinner together and just talk. Talk therapy is good. And I would ever so often see a psychiatrist, but I only did it in secret because of the fact that I didn't want anyone to know. You're probably aware of this, is that we have something on our credentialing that says that you have to answer this question. Have you had or do you have now any mental illness being treated, yada, yada, yada? And if you check yes, it can destroy your whole world. So I hid it for the longest time. And then there was just sort of this alignment of badness that came when I was 47 years old. And my husband and I had been in the military, but I'd gotten out. He was still in the military and he got transferred. I had been in a group. I had my peeps. I had my running. I had everything. All of my coping mechanisms were working. And then all of a sudden, I had to give it all up because of the fact that we had to move. And when we moved from Washington State to Virginia, big move. I gave up my home that was on the Puget Sound. I used to sit out there and look at the water and contemplate life. And I had to uproot my children and move them. And when I got to Virginia, I didn't have a job. I'm an anesthesiologist, by the way, and I had been practicing for quite some time. And when I left that practice, I hadn't set up another practice because I was trying to get the family together. So I was left home alone a lot. Again, not on any medication, not seeing anybody. And I tell people the darkness just absolutely overwhelmed me. I was in that place with only my thoughts. And my thoughts were telling me that I was not a good mother, I was not a good doctor, I was not a good wife, and that I should just die. And when they were talking to me, I wasn't able to say, I don't believe you. No. I was in so much pain, this mental anguish, my head, it just hurt. And I said, you know, you're right. And one day, I just ended up running out of my home in tears, and I ended up on a bridge. I ended up on this bridge, and
I think I remember from you there was a comment that somebody made.
Yes. Well, I had lamented to another parent about the fact that, you know, I had a teenage daughter. You know, if anyone knows about teenage daughters, You know, there can be this kind of, you know, headbutting thing going on. Because I had uprooted her from, you know, her friends, too. I was doing the best I could. But anyway, I told a parent that, you know, I really miss being a doctor. I really miss my practice and all that. And she said, you know, listen, it just seems to me that you care more about your practice than you do about your daughter. That just hit a nerve of some sort. And it just sent me into a spiral. Yeah, and I ended up on this bridge. And the voices, they were loud and clear. And anybody who's listening, if you've ever had suicidal ideations, the one thing about them is that it almost puts you into sort of a fugue state where you hear nothing else. The voices control you.
Yeah, I've heard other people describe it almost like go into a trance.
Yeah, you go into this trance and it's just like they're telling me to die. So I climb up to the top of the railing and I'm holding on and the water is below. And the strangest thing for me was that I'm thinking, you know, make sure that, you know, you angle yourself this way because, you know, if you fall and hit the rocks, maybe you'll die. You know, all of these things are going through my head of how best to do my jump off of this bridge. And it was weird, but in a way, it was almost like, you know, soon this is going to be over. It'll be over and I will not have to hear the voices anymore. I will not have to deal with any of these issues. I will be at peace. And fortunately for me, another voice came into my head while I was standing there, and it was the voice of my mother. But she just became a voice of wisdom for me. And her voice came in and just said, call your mama, you know, just call. And it almost snapped me out. Well, it did. It just snapped me out because for a moment there, I just went, oh my goodness, you know, if I kill myself before I call my mother, she's gonna kill me. A lot of times people don't leave suicide notes. You know, it's a sudden impulsive event. And I hadn't called my mother, you know, I love you, you know, that kind of a thing. But I got down and I called her and she talked to me. My husband found me and I went into intensive treatment at that time because that was actually frightening for me. I had no control over this event whatsoever. And that was scary. And I thought about the fact that all these years of being a physician, working the way I worked, trying to do all these things, trying to cope, when I went into therapy, and when I got medication, it was like a light bulb just came on. I had been in that dark place for years. And as soon as I started medication and just sort of talking about the death of my sister, my father, my relationship with my father, with my mother, you know, all of these things, just getting it out, it was like, wow, I feel awesome. Why did I do this before? Well, we know why I didn't do it before. And that's why I did that TEDx talk, is that I really want people to understand depression is treatable. And suicide amongst physicians is usually associated with untreated or undertreated depression. And if you're worried about, which our credentialing committees are worried about, is that for somehow a physician with a mental illness is an impaired physician. No, we're not impaired. If we get medicated and we're treated, we can be the best that we can be. But if you don't, that's when we are impaired. We are impaired because now we have to deal with what's going on in our head while we're trying to take care of our patients. And it's just ridiculous.
That's so wonderfully phrased as well. Of course you would want your physician to get treatment. And actually, I think in some ways, there's a narrative shift there that isn't so massive. That if we can shift it from, instead of worrying about whether or not the doctor has experienced mental ill health, instead we look at them not to be a role model on perfect health, which as a doctor you understand that perfect health does not exist, and instead look at them being a role model for getting support. And then actually these experiences can be an asset. You can genuinely recommend therapy when you've had it, you can relate to a patient more honestly. When you're not pretending, you can't relate to their experience.
That is true. And it's really hard. A physician with depression trying to talk to a patient with depression, there's a disconnect there, because obviously that physician nowadays here in the States, when a person goes in, I'm of Medicare age now. So when I go in to see my doctor, the first thing they do is a mental health assessment. And they say, are you sad? Are you depressed? Do you feel like harming yourself or others? And when I speak on physician burnout, depression, and suicide, I tell physicians, do a self-assessment of yourself and ask yourself those questions. We don't always evaluate ourselves. We're out there taking care of everybody else, but we're not saving ourselves. And that's me, is that now my mission is to save physicians' lives, because there's a physician shortage, I'm sure in the UK, other places here in America. And what are we going to do if we're, you know, allowing our physicians to die by suicide? 350 to 400 physicians in America die by suicide every year. That just has to stop. And we have HIPAA laws. And I've never understood why it is that we have to disclose our health history when our patients don't have to disclose their health history. Why are we asked to bare our souls? It's no one's business unless it impairs our ability to practice medicine. If we're doing a good job, you know, we're doing a good job.
Right, and that's the assessment it should be. And that's where there's such a hypocrisy that isn't talked about, you know, because I know from my parents working in medicine, there are certain things that aren't talked about. And it's not just mental health, like how many overweight doctors there are. My parents are qualified to know if a colleague of theirs is clinically obese, but we would never say it. And we wouldn't consider it to be an impairment of their ability to do the job. You know, something that is, let's be honest, for most medical roles, very thought and experience reliant. It's not reliant on whether or not you've got extra pounds, or doctors that smoke and hide it. You know, they won't go to the smoking area. They'll hide around the back because it's the same thing. But somehow it can be seen as more okay if it's physical.
Yep. I think that we as a society, as a world, whatever, what we can't see, we don't understand. And so when we talk about mental illness, you know, it's not like there's a tumor sticking out of our head and you go, oh, that person has depression. You know, they can't see it, so they don't understand it. And the brain is a fickle organ. You know, there are a lot of things about the brain we still don't understand. People ask me, I'm an anesthesiologist. So exactly, Dr. Charity, how do you put us to sleep? I go, well, I give you this drug through your IV and you go out. And then when I take it away, you wake up. And we do know some of the aspects of it, but we don't know all of it. And some people, I will give a dose that I think is appropriate and they don't go to sleep. And it's like, Well, what happened there? And then I have to give them more. And then I look at how much I've given them and I go, that's interesting. And they wake up. They do wake up. But it's just this interesting part about mental health and brain function. Some people don't want to understand it, but we need to be better at understanding it so that people can get on with their lives. I've been practicing for 41 years. And during that period of time, knock on wood, you know, I'm not that, you know, but the point is that my patients have done very, very well. I would be good at work, but as soon as I would get in my car to drive home, the darkness would come in and I would literally go home and I'd have my running clothes in my car. I would tell the nanny, listen, I got to go for a run. I can't see the kids right now. And I would go for a run. Get my endorphins up, you know, feel good. And then I would go into the house and I was able to deal with my husband and my kids. But I did so much of that for so long. It gets tiresome. I'm glad I'm on medication. I feel great. And, you know, and I love my psychiatrist too.
And I love what you said about mentioning the different doses you were giving people there, you know, the specifics of that, how there is this element of estimation and customization that has to happen, you know, and that's the same in psychiatry or really any field to an extent. You know, that speaks to perhaps how we like to think, because it's easier for us to comprehend, that everyone responds to things in the way we do. And of course, never more than in mental health are we shown that we all respond differently. And you gave a great example of that, where it can be so easy for us to get caught up in thinking suicidality is just one thing and it only happens in one way. And stories like yours are so rarely mentioned, perhaps because of clinging to that thinking, that sometimes it can seem impulsive. And of course, you know, there's maybe an in-between truth where it might have seemed impulsive, the decision you made, but in fact, the depression you've been living with for years. But, you know, that's so important to think of these different elements, because, of course, otherwise we're going to miss them. You know, if we allow ourselves to think that doctors don't struggle with their mental health because they know better, or somehow we think that makes them immune, or if we think that suicide is only ever pre-planned and thought about for months and months ahead, there are so many people we can miss with these single stories of what the human experience is.
And now with, you know, with COVID and telehealth and all of that, there is a way. I've done a few interviews and things about it because of the fact that now you can, when you think about it, do some mental health care for yourself, because now you're in the privacy of your home, you're over a Zoom meeting or whatever. I think now it's time for people. And as you know, this is wreaking havoc on a lot of people who have, they're having mental health crises all over because of the isolation we're already in. And
so everything for the first time.
Yeah. And not being able, their routines. You know, I have a brother who is a paranoid schizophrenic and I'm his caregiver. And it's that thing of when you break up that routine, you have to figure out a way for them to expend whatever energies that they need. Otherwise, it causes them to regress in what they're doing. So I do a lot with my brother. You know, just to let you know, my whole family, they were able to get therapy faster than I was, only because of the fact that I just felt that I didn't want to be found out. I mean, you know, it's an amazing thing to think that you could get fired from a job that you're doing very, very well just because you take a blue pill or a pink pill or whatever you take, because that's our other problem is liability. A lot of places worry about the fact that if there's an untoward event and the physician is on Prozac or is on anything, that was causative to that event. But the studies are showing that if they're not treated, there are more medical errors associated with untreated physicians than ones that are happy-go-lucky because they're being treated. It's a lot of work to deal with your depression without something to help you, be it talk therapy or medication. It was a lot of work for me. My brain would hurt trying to find coping mechanisms to get myself up to go to work in the morning, to do my job during the day. And lately, what I've done is I'm a stand-up comic now, because of the fact that I found that humor is also a way to help me cope with all the issues that are going on in the world. I feel like laughter is truly one of the best medicines. And so I do that also, but I am on medication too now, because it is important that I let people know that this is the new me. If they knew me back then, they might say, oh, Dr. Sheridan, she was, you know, kind of a nice person and everything. Now they see me as this bubbly, active, telling jokes, having a good time. And I love my life now. I love this new Lynette Sheridan 2.0.
I love that. That's great. And the power of laughter, you're so right. And then one last question to wrap up then. With all that you've overcome in terms of your own experiences of mental health long term, with family members you've had to support, with segregation, how that's affected your education, to what extent do you feel like losing Beverly and the mentality that you had that you were going to do that with her? You know, when you were little, you described you were going to become a doctor with her. To what extent do you think that trauma led to the ferocious ambition and drive?
I have to admit that if my sister hadn't died, of course I would have had a different trajectory in my life. But there was something about my bond with her that even in death, she was there. She was always there with me. And I don't know if I would have chosen any of that if it hadn't been for her death. I didn't have any particular plans, but I really felt that maybe if I became a doctor, that the other Beverlys out there in the world, I might have been able to save. I could save by becoming a doctor. Seeing her in the street at 6 years old even, you know, she was my sister. I really wanted to help, but I didn't know how to help. Now, you know, if something like that occurred again, I would be able to help that person. And I think that that's what drove me to do what I want to do, is that I needed to help other Beverlys in the world. I don't think that any other career would have been satisfying enough for me to break that whole trauma hole that her death had on me. It just she kept me going. She really did. And to this day, you know, she still keeps me going. Ever so often, I just hear her voice and think, especially when I'm doing something that, you know, it's bugging me. And I just hear her voice and I just feel so much better. Yeah.
Yeah, I can understand that. You know, that's what I was thinking when you've gone through something like that and felt so powerless and so terrified to not be able to help. Of course, you'll do whatever you can to not feel that way again.
Well put. Well put. Yeah, I love it. I talk a lot sometimes, and then when I hear someone say it succinctly, I go, golly, why couldn't I have said it like that?
Well, I mean, to let you into a secret of podcasting, that's the advantage of me not doing most of the talking. I get more time to think of my phrasing than you do.
But you're a good listener, though. You listen to what the person is saying. You know, some people, we talk, other people don't necessarily listen. That's why they can't play it back. Mm. But you do a very good job of it, and I appreciate that.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. It's a double-edged sword, because it means the better I get at interviewing, the pickier I am about other interviewers, because you start to see all the skills that people should have. So, yeah, it's good that that's coming across. So we'll wrap up there then. Thank you so much for sharing and being so open. If people want to learn more about you, where should they go?
So my website is drcharityspeaks.com, and I'm on Instagram at keynotecharity. It's so funny. My team says, you have to remember to tell these things when you're finished with your podcast. And I'm not used to doing that. Just look up Lynette Charity MD and you'll find all about me. That's fine. That's enough.
I love that. That's easy. I'm like that. I've worked hard on my website, so I just send people straight there.
Yeah, that's it. Thank you so much, Bobby. This has been a wonderful time. You made me feel very comfortable. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
And maybe when they open up, I'll get to meet you. I'll come over there and visit.
I'd love that.
Okay.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.